Welcome to The Property Wizard, brought to you by Creative Insight, helping you connect, and Gentry Learning, real estate professionals and educators. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Fred Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the property wizard, Fred Crouch.
A big thank you to the team at Carl Speaks, headed up by no other than Mr. Podcast himself, Carl Richards. We would especially like to acknowledge and thank our producer, Domingo Carrillo, and supporting this awesome duo are Nathan Simon, who created the original sound score, and Caroline Nicolai, who every episode supplies us with new cover artwork. Thank you, everyone, for the wonderful effort. Welcome back, listeners. So how about a quick recap from our previous podcast when we discussed adding an ADU, an auxiliary dwelling unit, which all our regular listeners know about, the right way, with special guest Nick Karangis from Ottawa General Contractors. Any thoughts, Bernie?
I think it's a fantastic thing that you have someone that can handle everything from your permits to the design to implementation, project management, and delivery, and helps you leverage your funding for that, you know, whether you're going to a bank or a lender of sorts. The zoning issues are not an issue.
Yeah, I've actually seen one of his initial viability reports, and it's quite impressive. They go through the zoning process, what can or cannot be expected on any particular project. And that also includes a preliminary floor plan and an estimation on what it's going to cost. So I have a project that I think both he and the client I put him in touch with will be working on. And if they do, we'll be putting in an episodic type format just the entire transition of the property. I'm quite excited about it. But stay tuned. We'll see how far it progresses. Anything in the mailbag today, Bernie? You've
got me. Fred, yes. Albert from Mississauga has a question. He said he screwed up and he's looking for a little bit of direction to get himself out of a situation. He inherited his property, a childhood home, in fact, that subsequently he moved into with his wife and young kid. A year and a bit later, he moved into a home of their own and kept his family home vacant while he contemplated what to do with it. The mistake was he didn't keep the insurance in place. He had a furnace failure and the pipes in the old house burst. Damage to the house was considerable because he let the insurance lapse. He has no coverage. What should he do?
Oh, boy. Well, next time, Albert, keep in mind that most insurance companies will keep the insurance in place if you regularly inspect your home. And by regular, I mean at least a couple times a week. And you actually have to have a written log of when you're there and when you're visiting. Anyways, but that being said, let's move forward. So first of all, thank you, Albert, for your question. It's always nice to hear from the big smoke. And maybe of some comfort to know that even if you hadn't let the insurance lapse, unless you did the inspections, the regular inspections, you probably wouldn't have been covered anyways. So insurance companies are usually quite strict about how long a home can be left vacant before the insurance lapses. Again, if you would have committed to doing regular inspections, and I don't really mean to rub your nose in it, your insurance broker is ultimately the best source to contact in a situation like that. So this entire scenario fits very nicely into what Bernie and I like to say, that if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
So you do have a few options available to you. The first option is that you can remediate the property back to its original, but in a more modern state, but you would have to do so using your own money and without the benefit of insurance proceeds. Although you could possibly arrange for a mortgage loan or a home equity line of credit to pay for the renovations. The second option you have is that you could remediate the property, but this time include an allowance for an in-law suite, or if the floor plan doesn't easily accommodate an in-law suite, then consider building a carriage or driveway home and turn your family home into an income property. That is by far my favorite option. The last option available to you is to either sell the property in as is condition, or have the house torn down and sell the property for its land value only. All these options are conditional, of course, on cost estimates that would support either one scenario or another. I hope this helps, but if you need more help analyzing any of the various scenarios, we would be happy to take you through the process.
So if you have any further questions, send your emails to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com.
From the current events desk of the Property Wizard, it's news of the week.
So listeners, today I'd like to speak to you about a form of ADU, auxiliary dwelling unit, shipping containers. And the article I would like to quote from was written by Julia Wright of the CBC News, and it was originally posted on February 21st. It's entitled, Shipping Container Shelters to Replace Tents at Site of St. John's Most Recent Encampment Fire. Now, I'm sure our listeners are well aware of what tent cities are all about. They are popping up in most every urban center, major and not so major. And they tend to be a magnet for those who do not want these encampments anywhere near them. And this entire article was precipitated by an encampment fire. And that meant that someone came and doused gasoline on some of the tents and lit them on fire without any concern at all for the residents that were either using or living in them. I mean, it was really, quite frankly, it was just a tragedy. My understanding is no one was hurt in this particular instance, but nevertheless, just not a brilliant thing to do, no matter how you look at it. She goes on to say that six shipping containers are being installed at the 110-128 Waterloo Street area by a local nonprofit, Kaleidoscope Social Impact, in collaboration with other community groups. Each one of these containers has been modified with doors and windows to create two 8x10 units, which will have electricity, heat, a bed, table, and some basic furniture. When complete, all six containers will have space for about a dozen people and cost about $15,000 each. So I know everybody's probably really good at math, but at the end of the day, each container contains two apartment units. The cost for each container is about $15,000 each. I think that's incredibly affordable and inexpensive, all things considered. We've been trying to manage the situation, says Seth Asimokas, founder and CEO of Kaleidoscope, which also happens to own the land. People don't have anywhere else to go, and we weren't in a position to push people off this site. Overseeing the site is Fresh Start, Inc., a local nonprofit the province has hired to provide outreach services to encampments in St. John. Now, keep in mind, this particular occurrence may have occurred in St. John, but again, I want to emphasize, that's not a reflection on St. John. These encampments are prevalent right across North America in every major and not so major metropolis. The goal is to get people into actual housing rather than modified shipping containers, according to Fresh Start's executive director, Melanie Vautour. I think collectively it's about finding solutions to support individuals and help them to get housed and get what they need. The only way we're going to end this is if we all do it together to support rather than judge. And that lends some weight to the argument that the first thing that you need to do is give someone a home. You know, all these support groups and all these mechanisms that the provinces and municipalities put in place are, quite frankly, serve very little purpose unless someone has a home. I can't emphasize that enough. It's very, very important. But not everybody is happy. And one of them is a gentleman by the name of Ryan Gilmore, who lives on the east side but owns properties on either side of the encampment site and across the street. As a developer himself, he says he's trying to build more badly needed housing. He said the encampment and now shipping containers are preventing him from finding tenants and driving down the value of what he's trying to build. I respect that opinion, but keep in mind, again, these type of encampments are meant to be temporary. He goes on to say, no inspectors, no permits, no nothing, he said of the new shelters. And I have a 28-page work order on one of my properties across the street that I'm forced to conform to house people safely. Seems a little bit of a double standard. One, I think, fits into the bracket space of emergency housing. I think what this gentleman is trying to do is very important in its own right. But yeah, I think that's something that the municipality could work on a little better. I don't know. What do you think, Bernie?
It's a fine balance. This almost goes back to a previous podcast we had with Fred Eisenberger and balancing up the needs for the community and what has to happen. You know, there's probably a win in that scenario.
Check out the new course offerings at gentrylearning.com. There you'll find answers to all your real estate investment questions. Divided into easy-to-learn interactive segments, it's the affordable way to gain invaluable insight and knowledge into the world of real estate investing. Start the right way. Visit gentrylearning.com.
Listeners, it is an absolute pleasure for me to introduce our guest today. Carolyn Troy founded Troy Valuations in January 2012. Since that time, she's led the firm to prominence in business valuation and advisory, handling high-profile assignments across both public and private sectors. Her expertise, honed through over two decades in Canadian capital markets, extends to guiding entities on expansion, financing, and restructuring strategies. Carolyn holds a bachelor's degree in economics from the University of Calgary, an MBA from Wilfrid Laurier University, and the Chartered Business Valuator designation from the CBV Institute. Recognized as an expert witness in Alberta's Court of King's Bench, Carolyn's insights bridge traditional finance with emerging technological and sustainability trends. Her forward-thinking approach positions her as a key contributor to transformative strategies, reflecting a commitment to excellence and innovation in an evolving global market. Welcome to the show, Carolyn.
Thank you very much, Fred. I'm happy to be here.
And it's wonderful to have you on. So this is absolutely great to have you here. It's a great compliment to previous podcasts we've had. So let's get right into it. Whatever attracted you to the business of business valuations? How did you start?
I think I'd always been interested in value. You know, why is it that the price of bread goes down when it's coming up on a day old, but the price of a plane ticket would go up? And so, you know, that comes down to supply and demand, really. And that led me to the economics degree. When I finished my MBA, I joined Raymond James in investment banking. And we were doing equity and near equity transactions and lots of M&A in the energy space, energy and energy services space. And I was writing, preparing these financial models and these reports. And it occurred to me that, you know, maybe I should have some credential that suggests that I actually know what I'm talking about. So I looked at two credentials. One was the Chartered Financial Analyst designation, and the other was the CBV, or the Chartered Business Valuators designation. And I chose the CBV because it focused on Canadian tax and Canadian business law. And I thought that was more valuable than the CFA. And so that's how I got into it. And I love it.
Yeah, brilliant and good choice. You know, because it's very, for what it is you do, I think you made the right choice and the right decision to go that route.
So explain to the folks what a business valuation expert does.
We provide expert opinion business valuation reports for the purposes of matrimonial settlements. You know, if you're going to get a divorce, then in Alberta, and I suspect also in Ontario, is the law is going to be similar, where you take the value of the house, the value of the RSPs, the value of the cars, the value of the dog, and the value of the business, and you put them in a pile, you subtract the debt, divide by two, and that's the settlement. So what's the value of the business? That's where I come in. We do these reports for buying and selling a business. So if you have a business and you want to sell perhaps to your employees and you want to know where you're going to put the price, then, you know, where do you begin? And the employees then can use the valuation report to seek financing from their bank or from their other capital providers. We provide these for litigation purposes. if the business has been harmed in some way or is accused of harming somebody, then we can quantify the value of the damages incurred as a result of the alleged harm. And that then gets used in a court of law or arbitration where the plaintiff is seeking restitution. So those are typically the three reasons why we get involved, and we're happy to do so where we can.
So just as a bit of a follow-up to that, because you've, you know, brilliantly answered the next question as well, but are there different, and under different circumstances, is the evaluation of the business going to amount to a different amount? And I'm referencing, for instance, we say very often in real estate that your mortgage lender, you yourself, your real estate agent, and an appraiser will all have different evaluations of your business, given the circumstance and the reasoning behind it. Do you find, given the circumstance, that that actually will affect the end evaluation of the business?
No, but yes. So the report that we write is a for-purpose report. So if you are using our reports to negotiate your matrimonial settlement, divorce settlement, then that's that purpose. But you can't then take that report and use it to negotiate a financing. So the answer there is no, but yes. And the answer for yes is that we use a technical term for a technical definition for what is the business value. And it's, I mean, I can go through it. I can't remember it off the top of my head, but it's, you know, it's the highest price between a buyer and a seller in an open and unrestricted market good knowledge of relevant facts.
Neither one operating under undue influence. It's very, very similar when it comes to dealing with real estate. As a matter of fact, I'd suggest to you, it's almost verbatim the same. So thank you. I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I was just really kind of curious as I was listening to you speak. So how is the criteria or the assessment process different when evaluating for an initial public offering, a stock option pricing, a leveraged or management buyouts, you know, versus buy-sell agreements? Is there do you use different criteria? Is the assessment process a little different?
I would say no, again, because we're looking for fair market value, and that's the definitive decision that we're looking for. But the presentation of the report will have a different sort of a scope. It'll have the same components to it, but you know, the conclusion would be perhaps different, where we're saying if it's for an initial public offering for an IPO, you know, we'd say that the value of the business at this time is. If we were looking for, say, stock option pricing, then we would say the value for per share value might be different. But in general, our reports are pretty standard. If we're doing a business valuation, we would look at using those common reports. The only other thing that might be different is the level of report. So, you know how business owners can get from their accountant, they can get a compilation or review or an audited financial statement?
Yes.
So we have something similar under the CBV Institute. Our reports are calculation, estimate, and comprehensive valuations. And these come down to the level of review that we have performed and whether or not we have looked for independent analysis on management supplied information.
So it's really a question of how in depth you can actually get into the report. So a little bit of a follow-up. Would you normally take a seller or business owner's word for as far as the financial health or the viability of the business? Or would you actually take it up a level and want to speak one-on-one with their accounting firm or, you know, whoever their bookkeeper is? Because it's also been my experience that some entrepreneurs are brilliant at what they do, but what they don't do very well sometimes is actually the books, nor do they understand the actual financial position their business is in. Do you come across that a fair bit? Do you actually seek the advice of those maybe, you know, maybe not the business owner, but a third party to substantiate value?
Yes, we do. So our process is that we send an initial document request list, and it's got everything that I can think of that a business would have. But not all businesses have all of the documents on the list, right? So, you know, for example, a retail store may not actually own the real estate on which it operates, you know, and then, of course, it doesn't have a great big mortgage associated with it. So there might be no long-term debt docs. So we get that information, we review it, we put it through our financial model, we come back to our clients with a list of questions. We like to have everything in writing so that we can substantiate it later. And those questions then are directed towards how much information about the business, either the business owner knows, or if they don't know, then they put it off to their accountant or other advisor. And then we get it back from them. So we do ask the questions, but it's usually a written interview as opposed to a verbal interview.
As it very well should. Great. Thank you for that.
Going a little bit further into this line of thought, what happens if, let's say, Carolyn, evaluate this business, but running this business or the money's managed by another corporation attached to it, which I control, you know, whether it's, say, if I own an apartment building, and I'm functioning that. Usually it's a separate corporation, but it falls under the shell of another corporation. How do you kind of bring that into the mix? Does that affect the valuation at all or that particular business itself? Does that factor into it?
So if I understand you correctly, visually, so we would have OpCo, and above OpCo, we would have HoldCo.
Yes.
Right. And sometimes beside OpCo, you might have Real Estate Co that has the mortgage on the land or building that OpCo is operating out of. And yes. HoldCo owns shares in OpCo and HoldCo owns shares in Real Estate Co. So in that case, we look at value. So if it's the value of HoldCo that we're after, the one on top that owns the two, then we use what's called an asset approach. We're going to value the assets owned by HoldCo. Because HoldCo and Real Estate Co. are not operating companies. They don't have an operating business, but they own shares in an operating business and in the real estate company. So then we separately value the OpCo, the operating company. And that operating company, we would use our traditional operating metrics, operating methodologies, where you're looking for the present value of future cash flow, and you're looking for a value from a market perspective. And then when we get to Real Estate Co., Real Estate Co.'s got sort of it's not a really an operating company, right? It doesn't generally have revenue in excess of the rental rates that are coming from OpCo. So we value that one on an asset basis as well. So once we figure out what the value of OpCo is and Real Estate Co., then we put them back into HoldCo and value HoldCo that way.
Brilliant explanation. This one would be a really good snippet for your YouTube channel.
Right. But so this is a really tough venue, right? But I know that people like visuals. That picture says 1,000 words.
Absolutely. You know, you did a brilliant job explaining that. So let's kind of shift a little bit. Would you involve yourself or have you ever been asked to get involved in family succession planning? Is that something that kind of falls underneath your genre?
Yes, but I don't do any of that negotiation. What will happen is the family will, so dad has a company and dad's going to sell it to son and daughter or sons or daughters or whatever the family arrangements are. That's fine. But that's a related party transaction. And the Canada Revenue Agency, CRA, is going to say, was that done at fair market value? And if it is, what's your capital gain? Because they want their piece. And so we get involved at that point when the business owner needs to support the price at which they transact. And it's better for us to get involved early in that negotiation or in that process so that we actually do capture fair market value. And that report then becomes a shield for the business owner to throw up against CRA's attack that says, is it or is it not? And the business owner can show our report and say, yeah, we had this done by a CBV and this is their conclusion.
Brilliant.
So would someone hire a business valuation expert to assess a business prior to purchasing it? Or is that the seller? Or is that either end of the spectrum? Seller
or buyer? It happens on both sides. Both sides. We can work for the buyer. We can work for the seller. We can work on a joint engagement. Those are tough, but they do happen when we're asked to do so. I'll go back to the idea where a business owner is looking to sell his business to his employees, that management buyout scenario. Often the business owners know what the value is. They know what they want to sell at, but they don't know where to begin the negotiation process. And they have the sense that their employees are not going to believe them, whatever the number is. And the other side is true as well, where the buyers look at this and they say, you know, they're often employees, but not always. They'll say, you know, I want to buy this thing, but I don't think that that's quite what it's worth, and we'll work for them. So we do both sides of that. In terms of joint engagements where we're hired by both sides of that transaction, we just make it a joint agreement and we make sure that everybody knows all the information at the same time.
You run into any conflicts if, let's say, I'm going to go buy a business and I say, Carolyn, tell me how much the doggy in the window is. Are you now getting into information? Obviously, the seller has to release information. Are you going to get into information that I could leverage in negotiation time, put them at a disadvantage?
So it's an interesting question. And I guess my answer would be that the buyer is going to discover this information in the due diligence process. And they may or may not recognize the impact of the information, either because they're not sophisticated or they've never come across this kind of thing before. And the business or the seller generally won't release that kind of information until he's got a letter of intent and or a deposit on the purchase price. So the business owner is going to negotiate as much as he can to get the deal done before he has to open the kimono, so to speak. The business buyer is wise to put a due diligence clause on his side of the ledger so that he doesn't get surprised before the deal gets done.
Okay, I understand that. Does that answer your question, Bernie?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, it almost reminds me of being involved in a sale of a piece of property and the due diligence process with the legal team, both from the buyer and the seller. And we went through, like, you know, what are the agreements that are in place? You know, an inventory of everything is as it stands now and the arrangements relative to rental agreements.
Right. That wasn't by any chance a medical center on Montreal Road, was it?
No, not at all. So many things learned over time.
Right.
Well, I'd like to combine the next couple of questions because you have answered a component to it already. The first question I have is that, do you look at real estate as being separate from the actual business? Now, not when it's held by a separate holdco, but when, for instance, and marrying that with the next question, what happens when the operating business is in a structure or building that is unique to the operation of the business itself? And again, not being held by a separate holdco, but is part of the business. So in a situation like that, how do you evaluate the business and the premises?
Good question. So the value of real estate, that be land and buildings, is outside our scope. So in that case, then I seek an appraiser, a real estate appraiser, and I have them write a report that on which we can rely. And there's good information in those reports. They write really good reports, I got to say. The AACI guys, they're just good. Yeah. In the event that the business requires that particular real estate, then we consider that in either case, we consider the real estate to be a redundant asset or a non-operating asset that doesn't generate cash flow, that is of value to the business, but it's separate than the cash flow of the business. So we call real estate, buildings, and land generally redundant assets. And they may or may not be required by the business, to be owned by the business. So I'm thinking of, you know, your corner coffee shop or, you know, even a manufacturing facility. They don't actually have to own the business. You know, once we did a metal manufacturing company and they didn't own the real estate. The real estate was held separately in a separate company that we didn't value.
Which is probably the smart way to do it. I mean, you should never, I always suggest to my clients that that's exactly what they do. They separate the real estate from the actual business. But I've also had situations, for instance, when somebody was selling a dairy production facility, which is very specific to its use. And in that particular situation, the business did own the premises. And, you know, it was looked at when the dairy plant was decommissioned. It became a redundancy because there was absolutely no other use that the building could be put to in any type of cost-effective manner, because you're dealing with very, you know, specific, you know, parameters and things that were necessitated by the very fact that it was a dairy production facility. So, you know, it just, again, it goes back and forth. I don't think anyone, or generally speaking, you know, a business is going to have, you know, their real estate attached to the actual business itself. That isn't, I think, a wise way to conduct your corporate strategy. But in the case where it is, it can become a little bit problematic. But you're right, the AACIs, and for the sake of our listeners, that means Accredited Appraiser Canadian Institute, they deal specifically with commercial and investment property. And they are well situated and very knowledgeable and have an incredible database. So that kind of takes care of our next question, too. How would you assess real estate component that's outside your expertise? Yeah, just brilliant. Bernie.
So you get this valuation. Is this something you can go to a bank or private sources of capital and say, hi, this is, you know, a valuation of the business and they're looking for money? Can they leverage that?
Absolutely. That's one of the very common uses of our reports, is the bank wants to offer the financing, but a large component of the value of the business is in the goodwill, right? This is the non-identifiable, intangible asset that's recognized on the balance sheet after the transaction. But before the transaction, it well exceeds the value of the tangible assets. And the bank then uses our reports as a component of their due diligence to understand the risk of the financing. If I could go back, please, Fred, to the question about the real estate owned by the business. That's a very interesting question. I just want to bring forward the two components why a business, if it has the reason to own the real estate and the financial capability to do so, there's two components, I think, that didn't get brought out. And that is, there's a tax advantage for the business to put the real estate in a separate entity. And then there is the mitigation for the shareholders. So in one case, in the taxation case, having the real estate owned by a separate entity allows the business then to pay rent to the real estate company owned by the same shareholder. And then that creates reduced income, a taxable income in the operating company. And so they pay less tax. And then the rental payments then become income on the real estate co, and they can write off their mortgage against that revenue. So it's tax efficient on both sides. And then secondly, there is the risk to the operating company that, you know, there does sometimes happen that bad things happen and they might get sued. And if they do, only the operating entity would be damaged by the lawsuit, and the plaintiffs are unable to, or with difficulty, pierce the corporate veil to get the crown jewels, which is the real estate.
Thank you for bringing that up. That's very, very important. I do have a question that has more to do. I'm wondering whether, to our U.S. listeners, we have something called CCA, capital cost allowance, which is a little different than what you have. Capital cost allowance allows a property owner to write off a portion of the capital asset over a predetermined period of time. My question to you, Carolyn, is I haven't done the math, and that's why I'm asking you. Is there a situation where the CCA would offset the, if the asset is owned by the operating company, which I think we can all agree is not the ideal situation, but is there a situation where the CCA, it would be better to keep the asset in the operating company to offset profits created by that operating company? Would one necessarily offset the other so much so that the tax advantage that the property operating company, or the, let's say, the shareholder of both, would realize holding the asset or the real estate in a separate holding company, which one would be greater? Do you follow what I'm saying, or I'm just making a convoluted mess for you?
No, you're not. So to be clear to the, for your US listeners, we both Canadian and the US allows for amortization. And in Canada, for tax purposes, that's our CCA, our capital cost allowance. Now, the CRA, the Canada Revenue Agency, gives businesses different rates at which they can amortize their capital property. And that can be different than the accountant's choices on amortization. So there can be a disconnect, and that's what results in future tax in Canada, but we're not going to go into that. Now, CCA is available on buildings, but not on land.
True. Yes, absolutely.
So you want to put the land over into, because land doesn't really depreciate. It maintains its value. There's no loss in land.
That's a very interesting concept. Have you actually seen that in practice, where the land is held by a holdco and the facility itself is held by the operating company?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't think I've ever seen that. But that's very interesting. I guess that's next level, and one reason why you're on the show, because
So I mean, land doesn't have CCA. And I don't know that I've seen it specifically, because again, I'm not going to ask the business, right? That's sort of, when I'm given a business, I'm given this thing that I'll only go out to the edge of what it owns. I don't go through and say, who do you pay rent to on the land, right?
Anyways, brilliant. Thank you so much for answering that. It was just one of those, earworms that was kind of, I wonder if, could you possibly, I come across it all the time as a commercial investment real estate broker. We come across it all the time, particularly when we're asked to assess the value of a property. We usually break it down into the land component and the improvement component. But I was just wondering, really, and I think you've answered the question, how would you deal if the two components were held individually or separate and apart? I think that's much more doable if you're dealing with, I can see a scenario where, a property owner or developer or business owner may hold the land separate and apart in a separate hold co, but would enter into, like a build-to-suit scenario where the operating company was building and responsible for the construction of the structure itself. I think under that circumstance, I can see how the two could be dealt with separately. So thank you for that. Thank you for that answer. So, a lot of people are under the impression, Carolyn, that there is no standard NOI, net operating income multiplier, that's used when evaluating a business. Could you clarify the issue for our listeners? It happens to me all the time. I step into a scenario and someone immediately says, well, and not speaking generally, well, any business is worth X number of dollars based on this multiplier. Is that the case, or is it different multipliers for different type businesses?
It's different multipliers for different type businesses. So can we play a little game? Do we have time?
Sure, absolutely.
Bernie, I did this to you once. We'll see if I can get Fred on this one. Fred, I owe you $100. Can I pay you now or can I pay you next year?
We're talking the time value of money.
Yes, sir.
Of course, you want to pay me now.
No, I don't. I don't want to pay you.
I want you to pay me now.
That's true.
Pay later.
Okay. Tell me why.
Well, going back to my initial comment, because $100 today is worth more than $100 in the future.
Right. Why?
Because we can use that money to create other investment opportunities. We can use that money to reinvest in something else that can generate additional income.
Okay. So I can think of three reasons.
Okay.
So the first is, so we're running about 5% inflation in Canada right now, especially if you put in food and fuel into the CPI bucket, which we know StatsCan doesn't and the Bank of Canada doesn't. If I paid you in a year from now, my $100 or your $100 would only buy you $95 worth of stuff. That's how inflation works. So you're down to 95. Now, if I'd had your money and you didn't, then I could invest it in a really safe investment like a treasury bill or a GIC. And I could earn 2%, say. So now you're out another $2 because you did not make that investment. So now you're down to $93. And let's say that we're going to talk about utility and then we're going to talk about default risk. So if I have your money, I can go and buy a sailboat and you get to stand on the beach and watch me go by on my sailboat, wave at you and you get your nose out of joint. Okay, so what's that worth to you? Well, maybe it's another 2 points. So now you're down from 93 to 91 and I'm a terrible investment. I'm not going to pay you in a year from now. What's that worth? So there's your default risk. So the idea here is, and who knows what that is? It could be up to 50%. Who knows, right? The idea here is that time value of money is dependent upon both the external factors, that's the inflation and the rate of return of an alternative investment, as well as the internal risk of that investment. And it's different for every investor and every investment, right? So Bernie might not think that I'm a terrible default risk. And so he might only lose $25 on me or only pretend or anticipate the loss of $25. So at the end of that 1 year term, so let's say I'm only 2%, right? So we go from $91 to $89. I would have to compensate you roughly $111 to offset that risk, to bring you back to whole money. So if I'm a terrible default risk and I really am, I might not pay you, right? Then maybe it's 10%, not 2%. And so you actually need to be compensated for that additional risk. All businesses have this component to their cost of capital. And this is the riskiness of that investment. So what could they invest that money in outside of the inflation and alternative investments? And so we subscribe to a number of databases. Kroll cost of capital is a big one that says, the riskiness of a retail business is different than a riskiness of, say, a railway. They're just different risk profiles. And so that gives us then the equity cost of capital and the debt cost of capital. And this is the amount of capital that the shareholders or the capital providers are going to demand for that investment in that company. Now, it's a complicated, once you figure out what the cost of capital is, then you need to weight it by depending if you're in equity or debt, and then apply it to that stream of cash flows, because a business is not just a one-time investment. It provides its equity and debt holders a stream of cash flows over time. But this is a complicated math. It involves, division and exponents and blah. Nobody likes to do that. But we can multiply easy, right? Everybody wants to transact at 3x cash flow or 1x revenue or 4x EBITDA. And that is there's a relationship between those cap rates and the weighted average cost of capital. And that the mental math to multiply by a capitalization factor is easy to do. You can multiply 100x3 and you get to number that's close to a weighted average cost of capital of 30%.
So are you suggesting that it's not necessarily incorrect, but it's a lazy way of establishing a value for a business without concerning the weighted, you know, cost of the capital? So, you know, because most people, I mean, I loved your explanation. But most people, of course, are not going to go through that, you know, do the math and, you know, actually sit down and figure out what it actually costs. So is it wrong? And this kind of flows into the next question, if we can answer it. Are there different methods? Can you use that method for all types of businesses? Or would you use that method for, could you give me an example of where maybe that method wouldn't necessarily apply? Or is that pretty universal?
Okay. So as I understand it.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Let's go back to the first question. Let me make sure that I understand the questions and then I can answer them. So the first question you asked is this a lazy way of doing it? And then, right, using a cap rate as opposed to this discount factor. And can we apply these methodologies to all businesses?
Correct.
Okay. So I don't think it's a lazy way of doing it at all. I don't. I just don't. I think that it's just a shorthand. And the number's close because there's enough variability in cash flow to get to a negotiated solution, right? Because ultimately, price is different than value. And I'm hired to give an opinion of value. So I'm never going to give you a point number. I'm never going to say it's worth $100. I'm going to say it's worth between 95 and 105. Because if I say it's $100, I'm guaranteed wrong.
Okay.
If I say it's between 95 and 105, I've got at least a margin of error in there. So price is different than value. So when you're buying a business or when you're selling or when you're negotiating with the bank, you're always going to look at whether or not, you know, you're going to have this either a really rosy forecast or a pessimistic one, depending on which side of that equation you're on, right? Are you a buyer or a seller? You can get there using the cap rates because there's enough variability in the assumptions around cash flow to get you to a number that's close. But when we do it, we're going to do it both ways. We're going to look at the cash flow over time. We're going to look at historical cash flow and then make assumptions regarding future cash flow. And we're also going to look at it from a market perspective and say, in general, businesses like this traded at that multiple.
That's really the crux of the question that I was asking.
Yes.
Like, you know, like particular businesses will trade at this multiple versus that multiple.
Right.
I know I understand the background much, you know, much better. Thank you so much for that, Carolyn. That's great. Bernie, anything to add?
EBITDA. Can you tell us what that means? It's an acronym. And there's so many acronyms.
There are many acronyms. And I did slip that one in there when we talked about cash flow. So EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. EBITDA. Now, that's an old term. Finance doesn't move, but accounting does. So we used to depreciate assets, and now we amortize them. But the acronym stays because it's accurate. And what we're trying to do is understand the value of the business from the determination of cash flow before the choices of tax jurisdiction. This is why people go to Ireland, for example, some businesses. They've been known to do that. Before depreciation. So this answers, you know, whether or not you should put your land and buildings inside your building or not, inside your business. And interest. How do you finance your business? Do you over-lever it so that you can take off a lot of the interest expense? Again, reducing your taxable income as low as possible. So we want to know what the value of the business cash flow is before those decisions, those accounting and operating decisions on tax jurisdiction, on leverage, and on how and where to put your assets.
Great explanation. Well done. Well, that was completely, listeners, that was completely off the top of her head. I mean, she is really brilliant. So we kind of finish up our podcast with a series of what we call rapid fire questions. What we're looking for, Carolyn, are just right off the cuff answers. These are more personal in nature, but nothing intrusive at all. You ready to play our game?
Sure.
Caroline, what's your morning routine like?
I get up at 4:30 in the morning and I go to work and I work until about 5 o'clock at night and then I spend time with my family.
What's your favorite book?
Ayn Rand.
Have you read them all?
I read Fountainhead and Ayn Rand.
Yeah, I read both of those, believe it or not.
Yeah, I'm a true capitalist.
And obvious by your chosen profession, but brilliant. Very, and a lot of people who haven't read Ayn Rand, she's written a number of books, most of it about capitalism. You know, it's the only book I think I ever ran, which really deep down is a true romance novel. However, she's been able to intertwine capitalism into both those particular books. Anyways, so thank you for that. Bernie.
So, Caroline, what's your favorite hobby or pastime?
Outside. I like to be outside. I garden. I walk my dog. I hike in the Alberta foothills. These are things I really, really enjoy.
Wonderful. So not on the script, but what kind of dog do you have?
He's a Labradoodle.
Ah, there we go. Why would I expect anything less? There we go. We happen to have a family bulldog who, if you take to the end of the driveway, he'll sit. And that's about as far as he ever wants to go. You'll never get him out in the field for sure. So you may have answered this question already, but what do you like to do to relax outside of walking in the wilderness?
I read, I walk, little exercise. That would be the rotten dog barking in the background.
He knows you're talking about him or her. Bernie.
Final question. What's your favorite place in the world to visit?
The Alberta foothills.
You can't argue with that. I've been to Canmore, which would that qualify as an Alberta foothill?
No, that Canmore is truly in the Rockies. But if I could give a plug to a Canadian, to an Albertan singer-songwriter, his name is Corb Lund, and go and listen to my little slice of foothills heaven.
There you go. Brilliant. Bernie, what's the word of the day today?
It's time for the Property Wizard's Word of the Day.
Well, Fred, it's called fee simple ownership.
Listeners, you may have heard this term used before, not quite understood what exactly it means. As a fee simple owner of a property, you have the right to do with your property as you wish. Improve it, lease it, sell it, or just leave it as it is. Ultimately, the decision is yours to make and make alone. Now, I say this, but there's a huge caveat. I mean, municipalities, provinces, cities themselves very often will have legislated rights of ways on properties or easements. So it's not quite as open and shut as we'd like to think. But generally speaking, those issues aside, fee ownership is the highest form of ownership that you can expect to have. That is the term that's used. If you hear it, it's just meant to convey the fact that it's your property to do what you wish to. So let's wrap it up. Thank you, Carolyn, for being our guest today. I'm sure there's going to be all sorts of questions and comments. I mean, I've really found this really, really fascinating. What's the best way for our listeners to get hold of you?
They can go to my website, www.troyvalue.com. So that's T-R-O-Y, V as in Victor, A-L-U-E.com. They can visit me on LinkedIn under my name or under our business name, Troy Valuations. So on LinkedIn, Caroline Troy, C-A-R-O-L-I-N-E-T-R-O-Y, or under our business, Troy Valuations, VALUATIONS, or on Facebook. But I'm not as often on Facebook as I am on LinkedIn. So those, my website or my LinkedIn is probably best.
Wonderful. And listeners will have all that contact information on our podcast notes. So if you need to get a hold of Carolyn, that'll be right there for you. Again, thank you so much, Carolyn. It's been an absolute pleasure. You've been a great guest. Thank you very, very much. So listeners, next podcast, join us on our next podcast when we're going to be discussing, and I have something really special in mind. We are going to be doing a series of podcasts relating and talking about real estate fraud, what to look out for, what not to do, and what you need to do to make a special or a successful, rather, real estate investment. Anything to add, Bernie?
Fred, the information today has been spectacular. Understanding how a business gets evaluated. And, you know, the reasons why. So I think one of the key reasons from talking to Carolyn before is don't get divorced or don't get hitched in the first place or don't live common law. But no, Carolyn's going, no. But however that said, you know, if you're going the divorce route, you're separating, there is a cost factor to it. And also to understand, you know, the other purposes for valuation. You're going to buy a business. Before you jump in, find out what's behind the door. We've seen that in the real estate space before you buy the premises, you know, everything from doing a building survey to, you know, what's buried under the ground. Is it going to come back to haunt you? This is the other part of that concept. Anyway, what the business is worth and how stable it is.
Wonderful. You care to let people know how to get hold of us if they have any questions?
They can get hold of us through your info@gentrares.com email address. That's info@gentrares.com. And also, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunity. Thank you, listeners. Till next time.
Thanks for listening to Fred and Bernie on another edition of The Property Wizard, brought to you by Creative Insight, helping you connect, and Gentry Learning, real estate professionals and educators. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentrares.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentrylearning.com. Remember to like and leave us a comment and subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode of The Property Wizard.